All right, yo, yo, everybody. Here we are on another episode of the Mind Body Marathon. And I'm your host, Dr. Leo Kormanik. And today we're going to be talking about general rehab principles. On the show today, we have Zach Goulet and Cody Shields.
Yep.
And Cody, this is your second show, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you actually recorded this is actually technically your third show, but the one we didn't ever released, it was the lifting one.
That was bad.
Yeah, what happened in that one? I remember.
I don't know.
It just was flat. I think, yeah. It was early. We just were all like,
you were nervous.
It was the first one.
I don't think it was really him either. I think it was just like a bad episode.
The energy was off. It was a time change.
Potentially. Yeah. So, I mean, I think like on this episode, you know, some of the topics we want to cover is just like some of our principles of rehab and kind of some of the Leo-isms and concepts that we have associated with that. And then some of the stuff that we do here in the office at Ohio Sports Chiropractic and rehab, which that term is there for a literal reason. But yeah, I think...
I can't wait to hear what Cody has to say because I used to have Cody's job. I feel like I gave the reins over to Cody. And it's been 6 years? 6 years.
It's crazy.
Maybe even longer, 7 years since I've fully done like rehab. So I can't wait to hear how things have changed in that world.
Yeah. So what's interesting is when you look at sports medicine from like a chiropractic physical therapy standpoint, there's the, you know, the soft tissue component, there's the adjustment component, which is like you're physically working on the body, you're physically getting the body better. And then there's the general rehab portion. The rehab portion has changed quite a bit over the couple of decades because social media and YouTube, you know, if somebody has knee pain, they could just chat GPT or go to YouTube and whatever and just like find exercises to try to fix their knee pain. And, you know, like 80% of the time that might work or so, you know. So a lot of what we see in our office is, one, we see people that have maybe tried that and it's failed, or two, they're looking to just get better faster, which is what actually physically working on the actual area requires us to do. It helps us to get everything healed faster. But it's just like anything, like what separates, you know, like an Indy 500 car mechanic versus your local guy down the road that just kind of deals with regular cars. It's like they're both having access to the same tools. They're both working on cars, but one looks at cars a little differently than the other. And one is hyper obsessed with performance and efficiency, and one is not. And so when you kind of go to a good rehab office, you know, ultimately that's the point. Like you're hyper focused on efficiency, your paradigm changes, the thought process changes in terms of what you're focusing on. Especially in our office, we tend to be more on the cutting edge of research, more on the cutting edge of like making adaptations. Like if an exercise doesn't work, then we just modify and move on. Whereas a lot of entities can't necessarily do that.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what makes this place so special is being able to have the understanding and pushing each other to, you know, think outside the box or understand regressions and progressions of exercises. And I think with anything, and even now that I've been out of like the rehab world and more in massage, even though like I can recommend rehab, but I can't prescribe it. It's just out of my scope of practice now. But even with that, you know, it's like having that basic understanding of the importance of rehab and then formulating a game plan around that. And, you know, if it's not working, like what can we do to adjust it? And, you know, I think that's a great thing about what we do. So
I do have a question for, I guess, both of you guys.
Yeah.
Like I think over the past few years, a lot of this rehab stuff has definitely exploded more on like the social media realm of things.
Yeah.
Do you think that's like a net positive overall, meaning like people are getting more interested in things that can fix themselves? Like, because obviously, like what you just said, you can definitely do the wrong or incorrect rehab exercise, but the fact that they're actually going out of their way to try, do you think that's more positive? Or
I think this is a fascinating conversation.
I do too.
I think I often joke, like if I wanted to have a video that went viral about managing hamstrings, and I told somebody to sit down and do a hurdle stretch for 30 seconds. That's probably not going viral. But does that make that exercise wrong? Right. It's like, and so we have this, whenever we appeal to the modern way of doing things, like with social media and kind of looking at that, everybody's obsessed with the new and the unique movement patterns. And I think that makes us look past some basic things that are, like, for instance, if we're working through somebody's rehab and we give them literally a super easy plank or dead bug or something like that, they almost scoff at it because it's not unique, it's not different. And, you know, they've seen cooler exercises on social media. But in the end, like, if you look at a really crazy calculus equation that looks cool and very few people can understand it, but then you still have to know simple arithmetic. Like, you still have to be able to conquer the basics. And that's what social media doesn't train people up for. They make people think that you could just dive right in and do this particular move and you would be okay. And in some instances, there's truth to that. But in a lot of instances, you're missing the forest for the trees. You're not understanding that there's other things that you're neglecting. And when you look at it through the lens, some key principles of, like, postural versus phasic muscles, which we should cover. So key principles of ontogenesis, which is basically developmental patterns of the body and why that matters. And yeah, an exercise might look cool and it might, quote unquote, hit the area you're trying to focus on. But, like, is it actually within the correct sequence of exercises that it should be? So I think it's just like anything in life. I think it's neutral. You know, I think there's some positives because people can come up with some really cool moves. And it's a lot of times you're like, man, I never thought of that. That's really interesting. But on the other hand, it's like, I think people are just trying new for the sake of new. And I think that's an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm with you on that. I think on the positive end, it gets people thinking about their own health and their own recovery. But I think coming to a specialist who especially specializes in the field that we do, it can then kind of put it in an organized manner of the direction that
yeah,
we need
good.
To go.
An organized manner. That's a good way of putting it.
Like, I had a case last week and runner, very spasm, like hypertonicity in like the low back, very laxed, like on the right side of her low back, very laxed on the left, especially in through the hip. And so what I told her was like, yeah, you know, like, you seem very lax. It seems very like, it seems weaker on the left side. It's very like tense and very just like taut on the right side. So maybe I would focus on a little bit of like mobility, loosening up the right side of the back and then building up more of the left side to like kind of, you know, to counteract that. And she goes, oh, but like, I thought I had to like strengthen those areas. It's like, no, you need to, but right now it's already in spasm. It's already tense. It's tight. You don't want to add more tightness and tense exercises to that area. But like, you're a runner, you need to do core, do it, but like focus a little bit more emphasis on that left side, let that right side relax a little bit, loosen it up, mobilize it. And she's like, oh, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. It's funny too, because I think, this is one of my biggest qualms and within our profession is that, so we'll get to like some very specific things so that people can kind of sink their teeth into this conversation. But I think this is an important concept and I've alluded to it before, but say you pull your hamstring, say you're playing basketball and you pull your hamstring. Well, 95% of the industry as a whole, like physical therapists, chiropractors, YouTube, Google, AI will say that you should strengthen the hamstring.
Yes.
But what's a funny conversation about that is like, if you looked at us three as workers and Cody was working overtime and then Zach and I were lazy, who's going to complain to the boss? Like the overtime worker. So when we get injured, is it really because that area is weak or is it really because that area worked too much and it's now barking at you? And so it's like, sure, maybe you can strengthen the hamstring a little bit, but is that really the issue? The fact that it's weak and they just need to do Nordics and hamstring curls? Or is it the fact that you've asked to do the hamstring to do something it wasn't designed to do? Meaning we should take the load off of Cody a little bit, have him work a normal shift and then bear the load more into Zach and I. So we attenuate the force across a broader muscle groups. And then ultimately, we didn't have to strengthen any one thing. We didn't have to tell Cody to work harder than ever. We just had to attenuate the pressure of that load across the region and take it out of that one muscle. And everybody errs on the side that is weak. Everybody. Because the logic is that, like, if it barks at you first, that was the first, that was the weakest link. Right. And it's like, or it failed because it was asked to do something it wasn't designed to do. It's like, you could look at it two different ways. So that's why you need to have somebody actually evaluate you and say, did your hamstring blow out because you literally have a weak hamstring? Pretty uncommon, to be honest with you. Or did your hamstring blow out because you just weren't engaging the right sequence of muscles in your hips and pelvis? And the next thing you know, your hamstring bore a load it shouldn't have borne in the neck, and then you pulled it. So, like, if that's the answer, then we shouldn't do hamstring curls in Nordics. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't load the hamstring. We should actually focus the areas. We should get the hamstring to be able to work through mobility, but not necessarily, you know, overactivating it. And so we have these internal errors that whatever is hurt is weak.
Yeah.
We think that. And also whatever feels tight, we need to lengthen. But we never really think about what areas are underactivated, because that doesn't meet our awareness, because it's underactivated. That's why it doesn't meet our awareness. So for instance, in that instance, if somebody pulls a hamstring, we think, oh, we got to strengthen it, we got to stretch it. And it's like, well, those are two conflicting conversations. The better answer is, like, engage things further up the chain to take pressure off the hamstring.
The one thing that I loved when I was doing rehab is, like, with this concept that you're talking about, is like when you actually take them through those sequences. And I'm sure you probably see it, Cody, where, like, you'll get somebody in there and Dr. Lee or Dr. Matt or Dr. Jared, like, gives you, like, let's just say core stability to keep it simple. And that person's like, I already do, you know, I do planks, I do this. And then you go, hold on, let's change it up slightly. And then you see them 10 seconds into doing that, and they're like, why is this so different? It's like, because you get it across a broad spectrum,
yeah,
of what the doctor wants to be done, rather than just like powering through core, because you think, like, you know, that I'm just going to get in this plank, I'm going to hold this, or I'm going to do this dead bug, and I'm going to just move my arms and legs around, and I'm going to get stronger that way. And it's like, no, when you actually get into this realm where we can, like, be specific and be nitpicky and actually get you placed in that proper movement pattern, it blows them. I just love seeing their face when you get them something like that, and they're like, oh, this is, like, completely different.
Yeah. And I was going to say, like, do you think there's an easy way for people to test that out themselves to understand if they are doing things properly or inefficiently? Or do you think that needs, like, a further evaluation from, like, a professional?
That's another good question.
Well, I think, I think that everybody, a lot of people assess the quality of that load that they're doing as, they assess it by how much it hurts, like, meaning, like, or how much, like, they're feeling the burn on the area. Like, if you're doing, like, abs and you're doing, like, crunches with an inflated stomach, you're activating the obliques, you're activating the transverse abdominis, you're not going to get a feel the burn in your abs in the same way. So it might not, like, be as interesting of a move for them, because it's more related to, like, coordination and dexterity. This is kind of where we separate performance versus rehab. In performance, you know, you want things to hurt. You want to challenge the system. You want to challenge the barometer of pain. You want to challenge the enzymes in the muscle to be able to deal with lactic acid, to be able to deal with the load of the muscle. You want to challenge the lift in such a way that you're breaking down fibers to build them back up. That's performance. But then you have another hat, which is rehab. In rehab, you shouldn't expect the same thing that you have in performance. You shouldn't expect your rehab exercises to burn in the same way you were doing in your repeats in, or your lifts in. You should expect performance to be, or rehab to be, more minute, more slower moving, a little bit more calculated. And you're not necessarily going to, quote unquote, feel the burn so much in that. And it's not that that's wrong. It's not like you would tell a musician that learned how to play chopsticks, like, it's not like that their hand got stronger. They just learned how to coordinate the correct sequence of muscles to play that instrument in that way. And that's what rehab is. It's coordinating the right sequence of activation so that you're playing by the rules of the way the nervous system was designed. And then once you do that in a controlled setting of rehab, that makes it highly likely that you're applying those same principles to performance. And so you do have to, you have to wear two separate hats. You have to have the performance hat where I want you to hurt, I want it to burn, I want you to get after it. And then, and that may even still be a strength and conditioning session, but then on your own, you need to be spending some portions of the week where you are playing by the rules, not necessarily vying for feeling the burn, but just trying to get the proper sequence of activation. And this brings us to the conversation of like postural versus phasic muscles, because the, you know, whereas our musculoskeletal systems or muscle systems sort of designed into two hierarchy of muscles, you have your postural muscles, which are just like they sound, they hold us posturally erect, right? They hold our spine erect. They hold the, you know, the rotator cuff in the shoulder. They hold the shoulder in place. They hold the hip socket and proper centration in the hip, you know, proper stability of the ankle, et cetera. And those are postural muscles. They're designed to be activated long bouts of time, not a high load, but activated for a long sequence of time. And then you have your phasic muscles, which are designed to be activated in phases. So for instance, the shoulder is a great example where you have four rotator cuff muscles, which are postural. They hold your arm in the socket. So in all the complex moves of the shoulder, the rotator cuff muscles are firing to keep the ball pinned in the socket. Now, a phasic muscle of the shoulder would be your pec and your bicep. Those would be two good examples. However, if the rotator cuff does not do its postural job, then your brain will recruit the phasic muscles to then do postural work. Next thing you know, you chew up your bicep tendon, and then you start, you know, getting impingement of the shoulder because you're recruiting the pec and the bicep for stabilization. When it's not designed to do that, it's designed just to lift. It's designed just to throw. It's not designed for stability. And so if I showed somebody a rotator cuff activation drill and they're not doing it correctly and they're still firing their pec and their bicep, well, I'm doing the task that you're asking me, but I'm not doing it in the exact way. And the analogy I use here is that, like, imagine if you, like, we all can relate back to, like, when we were going through school with math. It's like at some point you might understand a problem, but then the class maybe went a little bit too fast, and then all of a sudden you missed a key concept. You might be able to get the right answer on a question, but you don't actually know what you're doing. You know, that's happened to us a lot, where if you actually know the math equation, you actually know how to apply the principle, you can be given any number in any scenario and solve it. But a lot of times we can get the right answer without actually knowing what we're doing. And in rehab, this happens a lot, where somebody can do the job, they can do the demand that you're asking them, you know, the clamshell or the seven-way hips or the plank, but are they doing it in the right way with the right sequence of musculature? And if they're not, it's a little bit of a waste of time. And if they are, then they're just going to blossom and just be that much stronger for it in the end.
I agree. I think one great patient, this was years ago, who did, when we were doing biofeedback, remember this lady? And I can't remember her name. I won't say her name, but we had her do biofeedback, and every time,
like the blood pressure cuff?
Yeah. And she was doing dead bugs. And like when she first came in and you were seeing her, she was like pretty high level. I think she was also European as well. Mm-hmm. And we had her first doing it, and you know, the dial was going everywhere. She's like all out of whack. And then I think she actually bought one and was doing it at home and practicing. And then by like week four or five, she could adjust without even looking at the dial, and like her firing patterns were so much better. She felt so much better. She felt like it, you know, much more stable in her trunk, and like,
and that's not strength.
No,
that's just coordination.
Yeah. Firing pattern.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because you can have somebody that comes in and they're like, we see this all the time, like, especially in the NFL, the NFL athletes are probably the worst at this. Like they're specimens of athletes, but a lot of times they really, really struggle to do some easy performance tasks of rehab, because they can get away with how strong their muscles are, and it's not sustainable for the long term. So what makes a LeBron James versus a Derrick Rose? Like, why did Derrick Rose, why was he a flash in the pan in the league, but LeBron James can go decades? And it has to do with the fact that, you know, there's a durability component, but the nervous system component of that is one athlete was playing by the rules more and the other athlete just wasn't. The other athlete was getting away by their strong muscles and their giftedness of hopping or jumping and speed and all that sort of stuff, but they weren't firing the right sequence of muscles, and eventually the system fails. Like another great example would be like Zion. Like Zion's obviously a freak athlete and he's super strong, but yet he's also weak.
Yeah.
Which is why he's always injured.
Right.
So like LeBron James is super strong, but he's never really injured because his strength is different. His strength is more foundational.
Well, Tom Brady too.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a way that athletes can learn that before learning it the hard way? Because I feel like if you're dealing with somebody who's been getting away with their natural talents or their strength, like let's just say cheating or overcompensating all the time, you know, they'll eventually get to a point where they get injured, mm-hmm. where they're forced to relearn that coordination. Like, do you think there's a way that people can be more aware to try to solve that before they get, yeah. they blow their ACL or their tear their Achilles?
No, I do think there is. And I think it's up to seeing a good provider that will expose them to that, you know, let them know like, hey, do you see how when I ask you to do this task, you're not able to do it by firing this muscle. You see how like, you know, when I like lunge my thumb into this area, there's that trigger point there, but it's not on this side, you know, like kind of get them to be more body aware. The athletes that tend to pop and have long careers, they have great body awareness. They can describe things really well. Mm-hmm. They can tell you when the issue fails. They can tell you, you know, like what exact area hurts and when it hurts and why it hurts. They're very clear about that. And a lot of that is like kind of natural, but some athletes are just like not in their body at all and they can't connect with their body. And you have to often like slow everything down for them. And, you know, and especially done in the off season, in those moments, just really expose them to like all these other muscles that they are neglecting.
And they're at the highest level, so they'll catch on really quick.
Yeah. And you have to like let them know, like, look, if we take a step back and we work on our simple arithmetic, we will be able to get to the calc and the trig. We'll be able to get there. But, and when we get there, we're going to do it right. But it's like, you know, you have to let them know that, like, using the shorter example, if I am recruiting my pec and my biceps to stabilize, now those muscles cannot produce force in the same way because they're not 100% dedicated to phasic movement. But if we can get them to not be stabilizers and get our stabilizers caught up, now all of a sudden the pec and the bicep is 100% dedicated to phasic movement, and they'll all of a sudden be able to lift more and throw harder without even touching a weight or even gaining in any strength per se. They just reorganized the way that their brain recruited that musculature, and then it woke up the correct sequence.
We could get him going about Achilles injuries too.
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I know a lot about.
Question about that. Like, especially the shoulder example, like how often do you think the specific postural muscles themselves are weak versus just uncoordinated? If that kind of makes sense.
That's a really good point. And isn't it kind of the same thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, yeah, because you're like, you know, you're not going to necessarily bolster the sides of the rotator cuff and you're not really hung up on that.
Yeah.
I would say in the hip, it's maybe a smidge different in the knee because there you're dealing with compressive forces. So you might actually look to have the VMO and the glute med be bigger and get more blossomed. Whereas in the shoulder, like, yeah, you can probably expect some hypertrophy gains through the actual stabilizers. But that shouldn't be a goal. It should just be a goal of like coordinating. Yeah. And, you know, we can see this in the legs. Like if you look at the big three stabilizers of the lower extremity would be the glute med of the hip, the VMO of the knee, and then the post tib of the ankle. You know, you're not really going to get like the post tib to be much stronger in terms of size and girth, but the VMO and the glute med definitely will get stronger and you'll see gains in that for sure. So that's a really good question.
Well, I think even with like rotator cuff, like if you get a lot of pinching in like anterior bicep, it's just as simple as like just being mindful about activation.
Yeah.
So it's like not so much about, again, like doing activation, like band work to increase strength. It's just activation. So the movements that you're doing are much more effective for the muscles that you're trying to actually get stronger, get better.
But the other thing too is like when you actually get a joint to fire along its proper sequence, it feels right. Like the patient's like, oh, now I get it. Like they like there's just this general sense of euphoria. Like you felt like really connected to what was happening, and that awareness, now all of a sudden the nervous system is just like looking at that joint completely different from that point on. And I just think it's fascinating. But yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. And you know, when we look at, like all of this is sort of based around developmental patterns. So I think that, you know, and this kind of goes back to like dynamic neuromuscular stabilization or DNS, where if we look at the way we're sort of designed, you know, from being a baby and then getting to crawling, then walking, and then ambling about, and running and all that, and squatting and all these advanced movements, the very last sequence of muscles to activate are also the first muscles to kind of shut down with any issue. So like, if we think about like, you know, how active are the glute maxes on a baby that can't crawl? Like that's just like rolling back and forth on its back and to stomach. It's like the glute max is not very active at all there. However, once they start squatting and then once they stand up to start walking, well, the glute max is now more activated. So if we take that tact and then we have a hip injury or we sit most of our day, what happens? We get glute amnesia and our glute max shuts off because that's the first muscle to shut down. But if we think about it in that same baby, one of the first conscious muscles that you contract is your hip flexor or your psoas. So that's the last muscle to ever shut off. So your brain trust, that's its closest ally, your pec major, your psoas. These are muscles that fired right from the gun, the lat. And so your brain will almost never let go of those. So which means that if you get a hip injury, your brain will just go, turn up the structures that I trust the most. And then it goes right to the psoas. And then it goes, turn off the structures that turned on last, which is the glute max and the glute med. And then here we are with hip impingement. And that's like 90% of hip cases. However, in the rehab industry, somebody will come in and go, oh man, my hip hurts in the front. And then they're given exercises to strengthen the hip flexor. And then you can see when you look at it from that paradigm, the psoas was the very first muscle the brain activated. So why in the world? It's not a weak muscle. It's actually just being asked to do too much because it's actually not designed to be a stabilizer. It's designed to be phasic. And so the brain has thus turned it into a stabilizer, which is why it failed. And now it hurts. It's not because it's weak.
But it's like 90% of all people.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then I just, and your average physician will just do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so that's a really good example in the hip, in the shoulder, you know, the pec and bicep will take over and then the rotator cuff just shuts down or the serratus.
Is it, if I think it's part of like the issue too of like getting somebody to fully buy in and understand that, you know, what are you laughing at?
I was just putting something funny, some interaction.
Oh yeah. Do tell.
No, just I was thinking about an interaction earlier with the patient about this.
But yeah, like how do we convey that to people that may not be bought in? Especially when it comes to rehab and like the simplicity of rehab. And
well, we always have the advantage of most of the time that people end up in our office, they have gone through traditional measures or they have tried something else. And so they know that that has failed. And so when we look at things slightly different here, it makes sense to them. And it's logical, you know, like if something is a right truth, you can look at it from all angles and be able to answer the question on all angles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I encourage questions. I encourage counter strikes on these kind of ideas because I want to see if there's any flaws in them. And, mm-hmm. you know, often there's not. And so it's good to kind of like flesh those things out because then that helps the patient trust everything and sort of describes a lot of what's going on. But when you take these tact of like attacking, like looking at developmental patterns, looking at postural versus phasic concepts, then, you know, you're going after the general, you're not going after the foot soldier, you're going after the primary issue and not just the symptom of the issue.
I think getting that person to buy in. I always find it funny that like when somebody starts to see gains in their own health and their own progression and in whatever condition that they're using or that they're dealing with, it always comes down to, I finally dedicated myself to the rehab exercises. And it's not like a, it's not like a full-time job type thing, but it's like spending the time to actually do those exercises so you see the gains. And I think a lot of the times people put the onus on the provider for treatment and for you know, that type of care to be the thing that gets them to that point. But I think in a lot of this, it's not a magic pill in that way. It's a full team effort. And I always find that to be funny when I do talk to patients that finally are like, yeah, you know, I bought in, I finally put my head down and did the, you know, the stupid exercises, and I am feeling so much better now. It's insane. And you're like, yeah, that's what we've been trying to tell you.
Like, yeah. Yeah. I think like, that kind of on the same point, it's like, you should get immediate feedback, like right away, that it does feel right. You know, and do you see that kind of in your realm as well? Like if somebody is like genuinely activating the right area, you don't have to try to convince them. They immediately have buy-in because they understand like, oh wow, that does feel right. Mm-hmm. And it should immediately feel better. Yeah. You know, whether it be the knee or the ankle or something like that. It's like, if you can change the tone in terms of how the brain recruits that area, you know, the pain would just go away.
It is kind of cool too. Cause like, I mean, that does happen pretty often. You could almost like see it in their eyes, like when they feel what they're supposed to feel.
Yeah.
Cause like you just said, like, you know, it's like a flip of a switch, and it doesn't happen all the time. Like obviously it takes a little bit of practice, and sometimes some people pick it up,
yeah,
you know, a lot quicker than others, but it is a pretty cool thing when you can just tell that they figured it out.
Dr. Leo here. If you want to catch me in another setting, be sure to check out my YouTube page, Running Rehab, where you will find exercises on how to stay healthy with running, how to improve your running form, and a bunch of other tips and tricks on how to get over common injuries. Dr. Leo here. Be sure to check out my new book, Faster Without Fail, Your Guide to Overcoming Injuries and Running Faster Than Ever. It is now available on Amazon. You could read reviews on the Amazon. You can check out what other people have said about it. But basically, if you want to revolutionize your running form and better understand how to stay injury-free within the sport, this is your guide. Feel free to reach out and let us know what you think of the book. I would love to hear your feedback. But again, please check it out on Amazon. Faster Without Fail. Appreciate it.